Back with you once again Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Bottom of the 3 o'clock hour, Democratic State Rep. Steve Stafstrom from Bridgeport called in about all the hot-button issues being looked at under the Golden Dome at the General Assembly. Wayne Pesch, top of the 4 o'clock hour. Wayne heads the Connecticut Food Association. He gave his reaction to Governor Ned Lamont's latest pronouncement about who's going to get the coronavirus vaccine and when that will happen. And we spoke to a college professor in the area at 5 o'clock who teaches a course on conspiracies. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Steve Stafstrom, one of the more influential voices, I would say, up at the Capitol on the Democratic side. Steve, it's Paul here again. How are you?
Hey, good, Paul. Good to talk to you again. How's everything?
I'm good, Steve. And how has this whole thing gone now without physical public hearings on this stuff? You know, you guys and gals are used to, on bills controversial and not so controversial, being able to, you know, sit in one of those big conference rooms and listen to people's concerns. But you're still doing that over video. How's that going so far?
So, Paul, you know, I actually think I was not a big proponent of the idea at first. I like kind of the big room and everybody coming up there. And certainly as a chair, I like to be able to kind of glare down at members or whatever when they get a little out of line. But I actually think there's some major advantages to it. I think it's actually created a process where it's more accessible to the public, particularly for folks from our neck of the woods down here in the Bridgeport area and Fairfield County. You know, getting up to the Capitol and sitting there all day waiting for your 3 minutes is not the easiest thing in the world, as opposed to now, you know, folks can zoom in from wherever they are around the state. They can go about kind of their other day until their number comes up and be able to speak live to their government over the computer screen.
So could you, Steve, see maybe later this year, or let's say in a clean state next year when hopefully we're past this COVID thing to a great extent, could you see this, Steve, becoming a part of the regular hearing process, both in person and then maybe some folks who could sign up and, as you say, not have to spend 7 hours at the Capitol? Not that it's such a horrible place, but could this become something permanent?
Yeah, I think you could definitely see a hybrid system. I mean, the state has now invested in the technology to allow us to do these public hearings remotely. You know, they're all broadcast either on CTN or on a YouTube channel. So I think you certainly could see a permanent fix where those who want to come to the Capitol and want to testify in person can. And if you want to talk to the legislators on a video screen, you do that.
Let's talk about a couple of things going on, Steve. First of all, because I know you were instrumental in putting the bill together, there's an appeal now by law enforcement. We saw this over the past couple of days to again delay some of the more contentious issues of the police accountability bill. What's your reaction to that?
So it's actually predominantly one section of the bill. I know it's been reported that it's a bunch. It's one section of the bill, and it's the section of the bill relating to what is justifiable use of deadly force or not. And I said last year when we did the bill, and I meant it, that I was willing to take a look at the effective date of that section moving forward, because the goal of that change to the use of deadly force policy was not to get cops in trouble or throw them in jail or any of that kind of stuff. The idea is how to increase the level of training and move in a direction where police are de-escalating as much as possible and not using deadly force unless it's absolutely, absolutely necessary. The Post Council, which is the governing body for police around the state, did a very comprehensive review of our use of force policy, change to the statute, and put together a 11-page policy or manual for police officers on what is or is not justifiable use of deadly force in response to the change we made last year. But that policy didn't come out until late November. Yeah. So in my mind, we should give additional time for not just police officers to read that policy, but for trainers at the municipal level to be able to engage in actual substantive training and simulations of what is or is not justifiable use of deadly force in order to hopefully, you know, if not outright prevent, cut down as much as possible on force where it's not absolutely necessary.
Steve, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Steve Stafstrom is the guest. More with Steve on what's going on at the Capitol. Straight ahead, back with him first. Traffic and weather together right here, 3:36 on WICC. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Steve Stafstrom is the guest. Steve, you and I saw yesterday, obviously, Governor Phil Murphy signing a long-awaited bill in his state to get now the mechanics underway of bringing recreational marijuana to the masses there. The rumor is, the rumbling is out of the big building, Steve, is that is probably going to happen this session. Would you think so, that we're finally going to get it done or not?
I think it's still a coin flip, Paul. I've been a big proponent of it. I'm one of the ones who's written several versions of the bill, and actually the Judiciary Committee is holding a public hearing on this year's version of the governor's bill this Friday. But I still think it's a coin flip. I think there's a number of issues folks are still working through, particularly kind of on the equity piece to it. I also think what's unfortunate is it's become a partisan issue in Connecticut for whatever reason. There doesn't seem to be, at least as of yet, any prominent Republicans or even rank and file Republicans, quite frankly, who are willing to say, yeah, I support it, which is surprising considering, 75% of the state population supports it, if you look at the poll.
What about, Steve, and you're an attorney, obviously, so you can relate to this, and I'm sure this has gone around in your head from time to time. You may have heard testimony on it. I have police officers in the family. You obviously know many officers, I would think, and in law enforcement. One of the worries I hear, Steve, is that, of course, we have a recognized, we have breathalyzers for alcohol. We have then that's a follow-up test, with a blood draw maybe at the local police station. But what about the worry, Steve, by some law enforcement people who say, hey, we're not there yet on telling what is a marijuana-related DUI? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think actually we are there, and that's part of the reason to pass this bill. There's what's called drug recognition officers that a number of other states have used, and we have a few trained here in Connecticut, and those are specially trained officers who can engage in it's not really a field sobriety test. It's much more involved than that to determine whether somebody's under the influence of a substance. It may not be marijuana. It may be, something else. Mm-hmm. But the penalty should be the same. Whether you're under the, even if cannabis is legal in Connecticut, if you're under the influence of a driving, in my mind, it's the same as being under the influence of cocaine or heroin or any other drug. We should throw the book at you for it. And that's actually written into this law to provide additional funding to municipal police departments to get drug recognition officers certified. And I think it's something we need to do regardless of the passage of this legislation, because Massachusetts on our northern border has legalized cannabis, and New York on our southern border seems very close to doing it. And quite frankly, we know right now folks are buying cannabis illegally. I think if we legalize it, regulate it, and put in place those harsh penalties for driving under the influence like we have for alcohol, we can actually better curtail and make our roads safer than they currently are.
So this would, Steve, then pay for a certain amount of officers in each department to undergo this training. So somebody may be on duty, say, at specific hours, who could look at suspects with this training. Is that what it would be?
Yeah, absolutely. Predominantly what we're talking about is obviously the state police, because you're talking a lot of folks out on the highways and the like, but also at the municipal police level. Maybe not every single small town needs a drug recognition officer on every shift, but if say, for example, there was an incident in Trumbull and the officer pulled somebody over, suspected, mm-hmm. did a breathalyzer that came back negative, but suspected the person of being under the influence of something, they could call in the drug recognition officer in Fairfield or Bridgeport who would come in a short period of time and check that person out. And we also put in place, not to get too legal or technical on you, mm-hmm. but put in place basically an evidentiary issue so that if these drug recognition officers said, yes, this person appeared based on my training skill and the test I administered to be under the influence, then and that's kind of what goes unless you can rebut it.
Finally, the other elephant in the room, Steve, you know where we're going here, legalized sports gambling, and I've had so many people on about this, state-level people, national consultants. You know, we hear, and, you know, God bless the governor for saying, let's get this done between the tribes and sport tech and an outside company like MGM and the lottery, and I know you folks in the legislature, there are different folks there with different horses in the race. One of your compadres, Dennis Bradley, has a bill up. I know that mandates, you know, something end up in Bridgeport, finally, down by the water. What's an update on that you can give us?
So I think they're getting close, no pun intended, but I think the governor is holding his cards close to the vest. But he's been engaged in substantive discussions with the tribes. Again, I think this is an area where certainly I'm hearing from my constituents, and I think the public at large wants to see us legalize some form of sports betting. You know, God knows we could use the economic investment here in Bridgeport and the jobs of some sort of facility. I don't think we're talking kind of a major scale casino like was proposed a few years ago. I just don't think the market bears that, particularly in the COVID environment we're in. But some additional gaming opportunities and entertainment opportunities, you know, that would come from that, as well as the development of the new amphitheater here, I think could give a little spark to our city and to the region as a whole.
Would you say, though, Steve, that the ball primarily still remains in the court of the two tribes, and the fact that they do give the state, you know, a couple of $100 million still, even though it's been declining over the years, we still get that slot machine money from them, the 25% revenue?
Yeah, I think what the governor is particularly concerned with, and he's probably right about this, is reducing the risk of litigation between the tribes and the state. You know, I think we could all make the argument, I've certainly made the argument, that sports betting is not a casino game in the sense that it's covered by the existing compact with the tribes, and we'd be full in our right to legalize sports betting without the tribes. But we know that would end up in court for years to come. While I think we would win that lawsuit, I'm not sure that best serves the citizens of the state of Connecticut, and we remain hopeful that we can come to a mutual agreement with the tribes.
Steve, thank you. Stay in touch. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Steve Staffstrom. Steve, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Take care, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right, folks, there you go. So it looks like sports gambling might be closer than legalized marijuana. I was interested there that Steve said there still may be some bumps in the road regarding recreational marijuana being approved here in the state. But now we'll talk about something far from dumb, something serious, and a reaction by at least one group here in the state to what the governor said or what he didn't say yesterday about kind of how he's going to stick to the coronavirus pandemic vaccine hierarchy, if you will. Wayne Pesch joins us. Wayne heads the Connecticut Food Association, advocating for the food industry in the state, helping out your local grocery stores and the thousands of folks that work there. Wayne, it's Paul here again. It's been a while. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good afternoon. It's nice to be back.
Well, thanks for coming back, Wayne. We appreciate it. I got your news release yesterday, just barely a few minutes after the governor announced that, I guess, teachers will be elevated here in the hierarchy, many saying as well they should. But I know you, Wayne, and your organization expressed a little disappointment in what you heard or what you didn't hear yesterday.
Well, it really is going to make for some difficult conversations with, you know, our associates. We, up until the announcement yesterday, we had believed that, you know, we were working towards CDC guidelines, and, you know, the next in line were 1B employees, which would have captured almost the bulk of all of our associates. So kind of caught off guard by the announcement, mostly.
Yeah, about 30,000, you say you represent associates in grocery stores, big and small. I guess, Wayne, the governor's point here is that he is keeping an eye on the vaccines, on how much we're getting. And I guess he has a worry about kind of overpromising here and being able to or being caught in a scenario where you underdeliver here. He said he didn't want it to be like other states, which many people term are free-for-alls. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think there's two sides to the coin. I think that the governor did two things that are very positive. He cleared the air on a lot of the confusion out there. I mean, our folks have been waiting for information regarding, okay, when are our associates going to be able to get these vaccines? So I think that, you know, the fact that there's a timeline and everybody understands the game or the rules now is actually beneficial. And it just takes away that when do I go question that we've been asking, mm-hmm. right? So I think one of the most frustrating things leading up to yesterday's announcement was, when. So I think this answers that. And, you know, large portions of our members will fall into these age ranges and they'll get their vaccines over time. Our goal is the same as the governor's, which is, let's get the state back on its feet. Let's get back to whatever the new normal is. And obviously, we're going to comply and support those efforts. I really think it was, announced in a press conference and not really getting a heads up to let folks know that, you know, the winds might be shifting how we're doing this. So I think that was more of it than what he's actually doing. I mean, I think we're all supportive of teachers, we're all supportive of people getting back out into society and doing what they need to be doing every day. And we just hope that, you know, this works better than some other method being used in other states, and time will tell.
You know, Wayne, the grocery stores, big and small, the food retailers, many of whom your group represents, they never shut down in this whole thing. You know, many restaurants did, and then they came back slowly, and many, of course, all bars did, arenas, other gathering places. There were even, you know, clampdowns on houses of worship. But, you know, from the outset, you know, the governor stressed that, no, you're still going to be able to go out and buy food. You have to. So I can understand, Wayne, where you and many people in your organization have said, hey, we've been here from day one. Now, I know individual stores, Wayne, made some adjustments, you know, with cleaning and barriers and stuff, and you've done a great job. But you guys and gals never missed a beat, did you?
Well, if you recall, the last time we spoke, right, we spoke back last April, and we were pretty essential then. I just think, you know, the version of essential has changed, right? I mean, we're 11 months into this, and, you know, I think everybody's trying to figure out the best way forward. I will say this, Paul. I think it was much easier to shut things down, right, than it is to open them back up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the cycle we see ourselves in. I can tell you, our members, the reviews, I've been on the phone the last 24 hours since the announcement, and it's been a really wide variety of how folks feel about it. Because look, if your 50-year-old parent's going to be okay and they can go out and get their vaccine and go out and shop safely and get back into a restaurant, there's some benefit to that. So at the end of the day, I can tell you that our folks were essential. They were rock stars. They went above and beyond. They worked when there was a lot of confusion out there as to how the disease was, you know, the pandemic or the virus was spread. You didn't know if you were, you know, taking your life into your hands to go to work last April. I think we know a lot more today. I think that, we're disappointed and we don't want to overreact either. And we respect the fact that the sooner that everybody gets vaccinated, the better off that we're all going to be, right? So it's really a very difficult situation. And again, I will go back to the point, it's a lot harder to open the state back up you know, the sooner we get to phase three, the better off we're mm-hmm. all going to be.
And Wayne, to finish up, yeah, that was probably going to be my next point here. We're starting to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel here with numbers dropping here in Connecticut and across the country. The vaccines are getting out there. Do you anticipate, Wayne, that any changes some of your member outlets made are going to be, I don't know, permanent, semi-permanent? You know, were there, I hate to use this phrase because it's so trite, but were there teachable moments from this about just everyday hygiene and cleanliness and cutting down on disease transmission that we're going to keep in place here? What do you think?
Absolutely. So there are several different types of, you know, things, behaviors that are, you know, that were driven or caused by the pandemic or accelerated. So, for example, you know, we've seen, you know, 60% of customers who were coming in using some form of plastic. That number is up into the high 80s, right? So people are using less cash and they're paying with plastic. People are shopping online or doing curbside pickup. That's up over 100%. So if you weren't doing that prior to the pandemic, when the pandemic ends, you know, you're going to probably shop that way. The plexiglass sliders, they're not coming down. The sanitizing, protocols that have been put in place, that's not going to stop. Will the mask mandates and some of the one-way aisles and some of those things, you know, fall back? Absolutely. But there are going to be things that have changed. I'll give you another example.
Sure.
One of the things that we're seeing that's really, really interesting is prior to the pandemic, consumers were coming to a grocery store three times a week.
Yeah.
What we're seeing now is they're coming once, but they're spending more.
There you go.
Right. So people are spending much more in a trip, but they don't want to come three times anymore. And they don't want to go to two or three places either. So these are real shifts. So you're on to something. There's a bunch of different ways that the shopping experience has changed for consumers here in our state. And a lot of them are going to stay.
Check them out, folks. CTFoodAssociation.org. Once again, CTFoodAssociation.org. The Connecticut Food Association representing grocers, food retailers, big and small in the state. 30,000 associates, also 90 associate members, including supplier partners of retail and wholesale members. So how about that? Wayne Pesch has been the guest. Wayne, hey, thanks. We'll talk to you down the road. Stay safe, and we'll reconnect. Thank you.
You as well, Paul.
Thanks, Wayne. Appreciate it. Wayne Pesch heads the Connecticut Food Association. How about that? So some customers were going to a store two, three times a week and only doing smaller shopping. Now the number of visits has been cut down, but they're spending more than they were on the other times. About that, huh? And will the stores, like Wayne just said, will they stick with the curbside pickup? So, you know, out of problems, you find solutions. Regarding the Kennedy assassination, which has been steeped in conspiracy theories over the years, but that's something that actually happened. That was a crime. So a lot of people say, well, it's not really a conspiracy. It's an unsolved crime. Okay, crime. I can get into that. But especially in the past election cycle, we had a lot of stuff out there. Still unproven theories of mass vote fraud. Could there have been some vote fraud here and there? Yeah, and a lot of people didn't deny that. But this mass movement of votes, I don't know. I don't see any evidence of it yet. Who knows? Then you had QAnon. That's another big one that just makes me scratch my head. Of course, focusing on Newtown, you have Alex Jones, who won't shut up. Troy Rondinone is a professor of history. He's teaching a course at Southern Connecticut State University on American conspiracy theories in history and photography. He's co-teaching that with his colleague Jeremy Chandler, an associate prof of art and an expert on photography. And yeah, photographs play a big part in this. Let's welcome Troy to the program. Professor, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. What made you teach a course like this? Because I don't think this is your garden variety college course here.
I do American history, and I've been teaching American history for years. And I was just thinking about what I knew. And I noticed that conspiracy theories keep popping up throughout American history from the Declaration of Independence on. And so a colleague who is also very interested, Jeremy Chandler, a photographer, and I were talking about this for probably a year or two, and then we thought, wouldn't it be fun to do a class about conspiracy theories in America?
That must be cool. What is the, so far, Professor, what kind of reaction do you get from the students? Because, you know, let's face it, you and I, and I'm a lover of history. I'm in the middle of a brand new book now about, you know, George Washington and a conspiracy and a plot to, you know, to take him out around the revolutionary time. But what do the students think of that? Because I doubt a lot of this generation may or may not be, you know, steeped in this stuff.
Yeah, I think conspiracies come natural to students these days because the internet is just such a hothouse of conspiracy theories. But the students are also pretty savvy. They're pretty good at dissecting, you know, primary sources and things like that. And they have a pretty healthy attitude, I think, towards conspiracy theories. Every now and then there's like a true believer, but most of them are willing to look at the evidence.
I don't want to get into to psychology here, Professor, but what makes people maybe of political persuasion? What makes people believe this stuff? Like QAnon, for example, in the last election cycle. I mean, I looked at that, and this is just my feeling, and people know that all the time. I looked at that QAnon stuff, and I went, what? Huh? What? Why does this stuff happen?
Yeah. So I think the psychology behind conspiracy theories, there's a guy named Rob Brotherton who wrote a book about this, but lots of people have written about it. And they basically argue that conspiracy theorizing is very natural for human beings. Our brains operate by taking in all of this chaotic information in the world and then try to look for patterns and causality, agents, people behind the scenes who are making stuff happen. And so we naturally are making connections and looking for villains and trying to simplify the world with plots. Mm-hmm. And so this works, I think, both sides of the political spectrum. But, you know, QAnon seems to tap into a particular brand of this, which is very distrustful of the government and has a belief that there are evil, malevolent forces working the deep state, right? And it connects with, you know, anxieties. You know, psychologists will tell us that people who are anxious about their social position, anxious about where they think the country is headed, and they're just more prone to believe a plot where you could have devil worshiping vampire pedophiles drinking children's blood in Washington, D.C.
And there's no, and you know, Professor, there's nothing wrong throughout history, right? How many great Americans have said, listen, it's okay to have a healthy, emphasis on the word healthy, or measured, emphasis on measured, distrust or a cynicism about government, and we make sure that government is in its place. It's what we have elections for, hearings, investigations. But some of this stuff goes a little bit beyond that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a kind of a simple test you can make to decide of whether you're a full-blown conspiracy theorist. And that's this idea of falsifiability.
Yeah.
And it's an old argument, but it basically says, is there any evidence that it could contradict what you think that could get you to change your mind about it? And the classic conspiracy theorist will take evidence that seems to contradict it and then fold that into further proof of the conspiracy, right? The government denial, for example, is proof that they're in on it. And so if something is not falsifiable to you, then that's dangerous ground. That's you've left the boundaries of logic and reason at that point.
And then, you know, my two favorites, and I don't mean favorite in a light meaning because one was very tragic, but the two that just make me look at these people and go, huh, are the moon landing, of course, and 9/11, and they base it on visual evidence. And I know your co-instructor here, Jeremy Chandler, is an expert on photography here. They base it, Professor, on this video evidence that can easily be explained with logic and science.
Yeah, and the moon landing is, you know, I don't know what the numbers are now. Probably like 20% of Americans maybe believe that it was a hoax or something like that. And that one is interesting because there the evidence for, you know, the moon landing is so overwhelming, right? I mean, there were so many witnesses and, you know, so much data. And, you know, they put mirrors on the moon, for example, that you can reflect with a laser and bounce back that is all evidence, right?
Yeah.
Or you can actually see the trails made by moon rovers and things like that on the surface of the moon. So to believe that didn't happen is really strains credulity.
Yeah, and the whole thing with 9/11, too, in closing here, well, you know, there's no way that the jet could have taken down that building. And I have calmly tried over the years to say, well, no, the Twin Towers were built differently in New York than pretty much any other building. They had a central spine configuration. The windows did not hold any load bearing. They were not load bearing. But again, Professor, you try and convince this to people, and they seem to be enthralled by what they see on film and on the copious amounts of video that day, and don't use any logic.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a social scientist, right? I'm a professor, so I look at data and professionals, right? So mechanical engineers, for example, that have studied this, I would trust them more than I would trust somebody clicking around on the internet for, you know, an anomalous image, right?
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, with 9/11, right, it's not about the melting point of steel. It's about when the structure becomes unstable, right? And that's when it would come down. And so, but that's a mechanical engineering question that you, to really understand it, you really have to understand the basics, right, of mechanical engineering.
And sadly, Professor, that's above the pay grade of a lot of Americans, sadly. History Professor Troy Rondinone, along with his colleague Jeremy Chandler, an associate professor of art and expert of photography. They teach a course this semester. Man, I'd love to sit in on this. This sounds like fun. American Conspiracy Theories in History and Photography. Professor, thank you for taking the time. It's been great. We appreciate it. Take care.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Professor Troy Rondinone, history professor. He teaches the course along with Professor of Art and Photography Jeremy Chandler at Southern, American Conspiracy Theories in History and in Photography.